Bye.
Bye.
Hi, Ms. Courtney, if you'd like to meet me.
It's a pleasure, Patty Horton. Very nice to meet you. Very nice to meet you.
Jennifer Matt, Sergeant Director.
Pleasure.
I understand the law.
No. Pleasure.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is George Wright. I'm the Deputy Director for Media Relations at Army Public Affairs. Welcome to today's Media Roundtable to discuss the Army Task Force on Behavioral Health Report. We had to postpone it from Wednesday due to the weather event here in Washington, but joining us today is first Mr. Samuel Rutherford. We also have Lieutenant General Howard Bromberg on the line. General, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Over. I can, sir.
Loud and clear, General. Thank you. We also have Lieutenant General Patricia Horahoe, and also on the panel we have Colonel Ron Stevens, who wrote the report. This is an on-the-record session that will last no more than 1 hour. The format will be a brief opening statement, followed by a Q&A period. When we do ask the questions, I ask that you identify yourself by name and your medium, and one follow-up question will be authorized. Any questions? All right, Mr. Rutherford, we'll begin with you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon. On behalf of the Secretary of the Army, thank you for attending this media roundtable. I'm Sam Rutherford. I'm the Deputy Assistant Secretary to the Army for Military Personnel Policy. In my role, I will assist in the implementation of the Secretary's guidance on the recommendations from the Army's Task Force on Behavioral Health. Let me first introduce the officers here. You heard that General Horahoe is here. She's the Army Surgeon General, and among her many responsibilities, she is also responsible for key behavioral health components associated with the implementation of the task force recommendations. On the phone is Lieutenant General Bromberg. He is the Deputy Chief of Staff, G1. He has the overall responsibility for soldier personnel readiness and management, and he's also the designated lead for the Integrated Disability Evaluation System, or IDES, and I'll refer to it as IDES. Along with us also is Colonel Ron Stevens. He's a physician. He's also a healthcare policy officer who works for me, and he led the Secretary of the Army's review of the task force recommendations and developed the implementation guidance plan. The purpose of the task force review was to identify, analyze, and as needed, recommend improvements to behavioral health care and the Army's implementation of IDES. The Secretary of the Army on 5 March signed the implementation guidance for the corrective action plan, which contains the task force recommendations that will continue to improve the IDES and behavioral health care services across the Army. The task force worked closely with the Army Audit Agency, the Army Research Institute, the Inspector General, the Army Surgeon General, the Defense Centers of Excellence for Psychological Health and Traumatic Brain Injury, and the Department of Veterans Affairs. They also conducted extensive literature review of reports and findings of previous IDES and behavioral health studies. And they also interviewed and surveyed many soldiers and practitioners in this review. These are the key findings and recommendations of the report: that the Army must continue to improve the delivery of IDES and the coordination and synchronization of the numerous organizations involved in that process. This includes IDES program leadership and oversight, training and process standardization, assistance to the soldier and the family, and leveraging information technology for case visibility and tracking of individuals as they go through IDES. 2, that the Army medical community must move forward with operational positioning and organizational changes to improve behavioral health oversight, consultation, and care in both the active and the reserve components. A key finding from the Surgeon General's review of more than 150,000 medical records was that there was no systemic variance that would disadvantage soldiers with PTSD or other behavioral diagnoses. In fact, the review found that roughly an equal number of behavioral health diagnoses were revised to PTSD as were changed from PTSD. The recommendations of this comprehensive effort in the areas of IDES process improvement, oversight, and soldier support services, coupled with improvements in positioning of behavioral health professionals at command and installation levels in both the active and the reserve components, are critical to taking care of soldiers and families. This is a process of continuous improvement, and many of the recommendations have already or are in the process of being implemented. The Army has not been idle, and we have made improvements immediately upon learning of the need to do so throughout the period of this report being prepared. To ensure integration and synchronization with the many other soldier wellness efforts going on in the Army, the Secretary of the Army has directed that the Assistant Secretary for Manpower and Reserve Affairs oversee the implementation of the task force recommendations. And at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Lieutenant General Horho for her opening comments.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I welcome the opportunity to speak to you today regarding the Army's Task Force on Behavioral Health, as well as the corrective action plan that's been developed by the task force. This report has analyzed behavioral health procedures and policy. In addition, the adjudication of disability claims. We now have a comprehensive review of how we provide care for soldiers with behavioral health needs. The Army's review process was conducted by highly qualified experts, and the majority of the recommendations that you'll see detailed in the Correction Action Plan have already been implemented, so we've been aggressively working on those. Army Medicine has taken the actions necessary to ensure the behavioral health diagnoses and associated treatments have been standardized across our healthcare delivery platform. So we reviewed 154,000 records that were administratively reviewed that supported a diagnostic revalidation rate of 88% with regard to PTSD. This revalidation rate is extraordinary when you compare it to the diagnostic revalidation rates from the civilian sector. And the good news is about 80% of those that have a PTSD diagnosis actually remain on active duty. And so when you look at this, only 20% of those are going through our integrated disability evaluation system. And so what that says is that PTSD is a diagnosis that can be treatable. So let me just close by stating that I cannot stress enough that what transpired at Joint Base Lewis-McChord is not a systemic issue across our Army. So I look forward to the discussion and answering any of your questions. Thank you.
General Bromberg, go ahead, please, sir.
Well, good afternoon, General Howard Bromberg. In my role as the Army G1, as Mr. Rutherford says, I'm responsible for policies and procedures, personnel readiness, which includes the lead or in the synchronization of the integrated disability system. We welcome the report. It helps us greatly to improve our commitment of service to our soldiers. And it's good because it also supports other work we've been doing for over the last year to continually make this service to our soldiers in the integrated disability system better all the time. And while we've made improvements, we clearly know that the system is complicated and it can be frustrating at times to those soldiers who are going through the system and also to their families. We owe it to our soldiers and families to ensure that we have the best possible care, and that's what's really important about this report and about the work we do every day, and to do it in a transparent fashion so we can discuss the real challenges and get after them. Again, we haven't waited to make changes. We've reached out. We've constantly gone out, talked to soldiers, talked to the medical community, and including this very, very strong partnership with Veterans Affairs. Because, as you know, as soldiers go through the disability system, and as they're transitioning from the active duty into the civilian life afterwards, they get their support from Veterans Affairs. So that linkage with the Veterans Affairs is actually key as well. So, again, I look forward to the opportunity with my colleagues here to discuss this report. The procedures as we move forward and how we can continually improve our service to our soldiers and their families. Thank you.
General, thank you. Thank you all very much. We'll get started now with a Q&A. We'll start with distance stations. Hal Burton of the Seattle Times will lead us off, followed by Adam Ashton with the Tacoma News, and then we'll go to Patricia Murphy and then Kim Murphy. But let's get started with you, Hal, then we'll come back to the room. Hal, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'd like to address this question to Colonel Stevens, and if he wants to refer it, that's fine. And then I would like to make a follow-up question. When you went back and analyzed the 150,000 records, are you at all concerned that since you were going back to the beginning, and we know from a lot of the congressional hearings and investigations that have been done that some 30,000 people were discharged with personality disorders since during that time period, that the variance wasn't the only issue, that perhaps there was also an issue of people not being properly diagnosed to begin with, and that the review didn't. Why did you decide to look only at the variance issue as if that was, you know, the only issue facing the diagnostic community during that period, when there was already plenty of evidence that there was an issue of people never getting the diagnosis in the first place and then getting the personality discharge?
Sir, my role was to, this is Colonel Stevens, my role was to review the task force report and make and work with the Secretary's front office to consolidate the recommendations and come up with the way ahead to implement that. I will ask General Horahoe to, her staff was responsible for the review, so I'm going to pass that question to her, sir.
Thank you. Part of the reason why we looked at the review of PTSD is the original issue and concern that came up was whether or not we had variants across the Army and how we gave a diagnosis of PTSD. And so we went back all the way back to 2001 and reviewed 154,000 records focusing on that and looked at anyone that had a behavioral health diagnosis that went through the system. What OSD is currently doing is that they are directing, Secretary Panetta at that time has directed the services to go back and do a complete review of any individual with any one of those four diagnoses. So that will be done, but the focus of this particular review focused on PTSD and whether or not we were disadvantaging our soldiers by giving or not giving a diagnosis of PTSD.
But if I may add, there was a previous review two or three years ago where we reviewed all the personality discharges, and if they had deployed to theater, we sent them a letter inviting them to apply for correction of records to the Army Board of Correction. Those letters went out last year. We are receiving some of those files in for review, and that was for individual discharges with personality disorder who had been in Iraq or Afghanistan, and we wanted to rule out any possible comorbidity of PTSD and TBI because those were very early on in the war.
Hal, you had a follow-up? Hal Burton, you had a follow-up question? We may have lost Hal. We'll come back. Adam Ashman, go ahead.
I'll apologize. I had a problem on my end.
Okay. Back to you, Hal. Your follow-up question, please.
My follow-up question was, there was a part of the report which talked about the importance of an independent review during the evaluation phase and not having the doctors who were doing the care make those independent reviews. And a recommendation based upon some of that. What I was wondering is, because it was never quite clearly stated, is why are forensic psychiatrists not qualified, not deemed appropriate to make those reviews, since that was, you know, part of the original thing that got things going, that they were making independent reviews, but they were forensic psychiatrists. So why are they not appropriate compared to others? Behavioral health specialist.
I'll take that one if that's okay. It's not that they're inappropriate and don't have the capabilities to do that. Is that we don't have forensic capability that can be utilized across every single place that we have the integrated disability evaluation system. So when you're looking at trying to have a standard across the board, what we wanted to do is to make sure that we had the same capability at every place we were making IDES decisions, and so we use our forensic psychiatrist when we need to have the evaluations between the medical and the law and use sometimes in different cases, but within the disability process, because we don't have that capability that we could have uniformly, we made a decision that we would have a separate behavioral health provider would make that independent decision. And so when we started this, we had behavioral health providers that were providing care as well as working in the disability evaluation process. And what we found is through a modeling technique over years of doing this that we needed 136 behavioral health providers dedicated to the disability process. We hired those and had those individuals that did the administrative procedures. So that's the standard that we put in place.
Thank you, ma'am.
We'll go to the Tacoma News with Adam Ashton, and we'll follow with KUOW. Go ahead, Adam.
Thank you. So in our stories, we've often used the word reversal to refer to the changes in diagnoses made by Madigan's forensic psychiatrist. We've also heard them referred to as downgrading a diagnosis from PTSD to another condition. And I want to ask, is that accurate, or were those original diagnoses made with the DSM-4 criteria and the more recent adjustments made with the DSM-5 criteria that de-emphasized the need to feel fear in a moment, a traumatic moment?
I'll take that one. You know, when you look in the civilian sector, if you look through the literature, revalidation or variance, it can range anywhere from about 48% going up to 89%. And so when we looked at our variance across, when we did this review of 154,000 records, we found our variance was about 12%. And so we are much lower than the civilian sector. And it's because behavioral health care is an art and a science. And so part of what we also realized is that the way that we train our soldiers, we train them, and a lot of them don't experience shock and awe, which is part of the DSM-4. And so we have worked with the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, to put the right criteria in place to come out with a new criteria that you just referred to, which is the DSM-5, and we're already starting to use that. So this has been evolving for our nation, not just our military, but actually for our nation when we look at behavioral health care.
But what I mean is, if the forensic psychiatrists who have been criticized, or I mean, have been criticized for downgrading diagnoses, I mean, did they downgrade diagnoses, or were they using one standard that the Army has moved away from?
The standard that they were using at that time was DSM-4, because that was the standard that was used across the board. It's not that they were downgrading. It's the variance that I talked about, is that there is variance when one physician will do an evaluation administratively and you'll have another physician do it. You may get a very different answer. And that's why we've seen in the civilian sector the variance going from 49% to 89%. That revalidation is very, very different based on the individuals that do that. And so that's the same thing we saw with forensics.
Ma'am, if I may.
So at Madigan, was that variance different from the Army normal, or was that variance in keeping with the Army trend? In the report, you mentioned two hospitals that were different from the trend. Was Madigan in that norm, or was it outside of it?
At the time frame from 2007 to 2012, Madigan had a variance rate of about 21%, which was higher than what we saw at the other places. But when we did the whole review across the 154,000 records and going back to 9/11, then you saw Madigan's rate going down to about 13%.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's go to KUOW, then we'll go to the LA Times, and we'll come back to the room to the Washington Times. Go ahead, Patricia.
Thank you. This is a question for Lieutenant General Horoho. You mentioned that Joint Base Lewis-McChord and Madigan was not a systemic problem. This was not representative of what was going on within the Army system. What kind of light can you shed on the situation that was going on at Madigan? What were we dealing with? You already said there was a variance rate there that was higher, but what was going on?
The difference that had occurred, if you go back to the 2008 time frame, we were in the disability evaluation system, which was a legacy disability evaluation system. And then in the 2010 time frame is when the entire Army and Department of Defense started transitioning to the integrated disability evaluation system, where there was a one standard with the VA and with the Department of Defense, and so that those that went through the evaluation system would get their disability check within 30 days, by having to sometimes wait 12 months to 18 months. And so that was the improvement with that. The variance that we saw within Madigan was that Madigan continued to use the forensic psychiatrist within their medical evaluation process, and we were not using that capability anywhere else. And so that's the variance that was seen there. However, we stopped that so that we had one standard across the board, but there was no intentional malice, nor was there wrongdoing that was seen by the way that they were doing the evaluation in that again. It was just a difference in capability.
So how can soldiers who are going through the disability evaluation system and seeking treatment for post-traumatic stress at Madigan have faith and confidence that they're being treated appropriately and being diagnosed appropriately at Madigan?
As the Army Surgeon General, I feel very comfortable saying that I have complete faith in the capability that we have at Madigan Army Medical Center. Some of the wonderful adjustments that they did afterwards, we're a learning organization. We're continually making improvements. Madigan Army Medical Center, after this, brought together their psychology department, their social work department, their psychiatric department, and synchronized all of those into one department, which is seen as the best standard in the civilian sector. We have 90% of our hospitals right now have transitioned to that integrated interdisciplinary healthcare team. And I think Madigan has very dedicated and well-trained clinicians that are providing the treatment aspect. And then we have separated out those healthcare providers that treat from those that are the administrative review at the disability process. So what you'll see at Madigan now is the same thing you'll see at every post-camp and station, which is one standard across the board, and we implemented Annex O that that articulates what that standard is everywhere.
Is forensic psychiatry still being used at Madigan?
Forensic psychiatry is being used in the field of forensic psychiatry, but it is not being used in the medical evaluation process.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll go to Ken Murphy of L.A. Times, and we'll come back to the room to Christina, and after that we'll go to Michelle Tan back with the Army Times. Go ahead, Kim.
Hello. Some of the initial concerns that were raised at Madigan about the PTSD diagnosis reversals had to do with soldiers who were accused of malingering, and expressions of concern that some soldiers, perhaps too many, were claiming PTSD when they didn't really have a PTSD, and that this was going to cost the Army a heck of a lot of money. I don't think anybody is saying that service members who suffer trauma from the war should not be taken care of completely, but it is your job to be stewards of the taxpayers' money as well. And I was wondering if you, during this evaluation, managed to come to any conclusions about the levels of, you know, false claims that are being filed, number one, and number two, what estimates of cost exist now within the Army for paying some of the costs associated with PTSD diagnosis.
Howard, do you want to take that one from the disability piece?
Yes. You know, we didn't see anything in this look that was related to monetary. Your word I'll use would be, you know, monetary incentives in the system. And, you know, throughout the process of the disability system, soldiers have multiple points of where they can get second reviews if they disagree with the diagnosis they've got as they work with the VA. This process goes all the way up until their final VA rating, to where they can, if they disagree with what the rating that the VA is going to give them, they have a chance to rebut that rating. It goes to another review. And before they're discharged, they have one more opportunity to do that before the final decision is made. But I didn't see any thing in the report that related to monetary incentives related to this discussion. And I don't have any monetary costs associated to provide. Over.
Ken, follow up?
That'll do it for me.
Okay. Let's come into the room and talk to Christina Wong with the Washington Times.
Great, thank you. Lieutenant General Horowitz, thank you so much. Just wanted to ask you, you know, how we're doing on the mental health care provider shortage and how telehealth can address that.
And
whether we know if it's effective or not now.
That's, I'll answer a couple because you have a couple things in there. So the first one is we actually, over the last couple of years, we've more than doubled our behavioral health providers. And so we've overhired and we have telebehavioral health capability in several hubs across the United States. Triple Army Medical Center is one of our hubs. Europe is a hub. We've got Walter Reed is a hub, San Antonio. And so we have, and Madigan Army Medical Center is another hub, and so we actually use that capability to provide, like Tripler provides behavioral health to Alaska. So areas where we know it's hard to hire behavioral health providers, we're using that. We're also using telebehavioral health and theater in Afghanistan, and our intent there and the culture change is trying to make sure you have behavioral health capability early so that you're not waiting till someone redeploys back to start taking care of the behavioral health needs. So we're using that aggressively. We have just rolled out, December, we rolled out a behavioral health data portal. And so this is the first time, military or civilian, that there is a behavioral health outcome-based capability. So we are now going to start being able to evaluate how effective our provision of behavioral health care is. So a year from now, I probably can give you a much better answer with a year's worth of data. But we just rolled that capability out in the December timeframe.
Great. And I have a follow-up for Lieutenant General Bromberg while you're here. If you could, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Great. Thank you so much. I just wanted to get your comment on, you know, the suspension of tuition assistance and how that might affect recruiting and whether you're concerned about that.
Hey, Christina, we'll save that for a different one, and maybe Lieutenant Colonel Alexander can.
I'd like to hear the answer to that too. If we all live here, can we just go with it?
There was just something released today, and so.
Okay, General Bromberg, if you would speak briefly on that, we'd be grateful. Please.
Yeah, certainly. Unfortunately, due to the budgetary situation we're in, that we've had to cease new enrollments in tuition assistance until we have some more clarity. At this point, I think it's too early to tell if there's going to be an effect on retention or recruiting. It's a very robust program. In addition, this is tuition assistance, and soldiers still have the opportunity to use their GI Bill benefits. So there's still other benefits that are out there for soldiers to use to increase their education. We'll know more in the coming weeks as the budget situation gets a little clearer. But this does not cancel the program. We're very clear about this. This just ceases enrollment as we know it today. And then we'll make appropriate adjustments as the budget clarifies.
Thank you.
Thanks, General. Let's go to Michelle Tan with the Army Times, and then we'll come back to Courtney Cuby with NBC. Michelle, go ahead.
Thanks, George. I had a question. I was looking for more detail, if you could, about the embedded behavioral health teams that you'd be putting with the brigade level units. Can someone talk more about who you're going to be putting in there and kind of when you might make this happen?
I'll take that one. That's one of our initiatives that we've been actually rolling out over the last year, and we're projected to have it completed over the next several years. So we have found through embedding behavioral health in our brigade combat teams that we actually improve behavioral health outcomes just because of having that capability, habitual relationship, and people feeling much more open to be able to seek behavioral health care. And so we have aggressively been rolling that out. We're also looking at having them embedded in our non-brigade combat teams because areas, so those that are supporting our generating force, because we want to get healthcare outside of the bricks and mortar and into what we're calling the life space. And it's where people make decisions on sleep, activity, nutrition, and healthcare. And so we're really aggressively pushing that concept and capability outside of our bricks and mortar.
Oh, thank you. And can you talk, ma'am, a little bit about what kind of capability? Are we talking psychologists, social workers?
All of those above. So we have, we actually have behavioral health techs. We've got social workers. We've got psychologists. We also have psychiatrists. And in addition to that, we're putting physical therapists into our brigade combat teams because we've seen that has decreased orthopedic injuries. And so we're really focusing on wellness, the holistic aspect of our soldiers, both the physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional.
If I could jump in here as General Bromberg, this is a great concept shift as General Horowitz said, we're a learning organization. And just as we learned many years ago when we started our Combat Lifesaver program, where we train more soldiers in units and increase medical care at the point of injury. So when you're suffering a combat injury from a kinetic injury, the more care you push forward, the better chances of survival you have as you move back through the medical system. That's greatly revolutionized the way we've done things tactically. So now the next logical step is behavioral health as well as physical therapy, as General Horoho mentioned, because we realize now that we have to have this capability. And it's one of those checks a commander makes now, because previous to the last 10 years, you know, we'd always check all the things you needed to have to do your mission, from fuel to food to ammunition to basic medical care. Now we've realized we needed to add that behavioral health piece as we look at making our force, our great force, which is a very strong and resilient force today, making it a more resilient force in the future. So moving this capability down to where the soldiers are on a daily basis is tremendously powerful. The other thing it does to help us, it helps us to get after the stigma of behavioral health. If you have behavioral health capability in your formations, in your motor pools, in your areas where you do physical training, people are more likely to use that. It's more, it becomes more the norm then versus always having to go back to the brick and mortar, as General Horoho had said. So I think this is just a great revolution for us as we move forward, as we learn and continually improve the service and capabilities to our formations.
Over. Sir, if I may, this is Colonel Stevens. One more comment I would make in addition to just a direct care that is provided to the soldiers in the units. It also allows for a habitual relationship to exist between the commander or the leadership of the unit and the behavioral health care professionals so they can collaborate appropriately with for the care of the soldier to ensure that we maximize the services that are available, as well as teaching classes to the units. So in addition to just the direct care, it's also just an overall behavioral health program that's available to the soldiers in the units with the embedded providers.
I have a quick follow-up, George. Okay.
Okay.
I assume these teams, they're all soldiers. Do you have enough qualified and trained soldiers to fill these billets?
Yeah, they're not all soldiers. We have civilians as well as our military. So if you go out to Fort Carson, which was actually one of our very first places that we did the pilot, and then when we saw such positive outcomes, what they did is that we took our civilian behavioral health team members out of the military treatment facility and actually had them physically located in the footprint of where the brigade was. And so when that brigade combat team deployed, then that relationship continued. And so then when they redeployed back, they were coming back to a familiar face, and there was a trust there. And so we're using both military and civilian, and we're also using a lot of telebehavioral health to leverage that capability where we can't hire.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We'll come back to the room to Courtney, and then we'll go to Fed News Radio and then NBC.com. Courtney, go ahead.
Back to Madigan, I think this might be best for you, General Horoho. How can you be certain when you're doing this evaluation of these 154,000 or of specifically at Madigan, how can you be certain that there was no malicious intent on the part of the healthcare providers when they were making those diagnoses that somebody was asking about being taxpayer, stewards of the taxpayer? How can you be 100% certain that it was nothing more than it seems like human error? Frankly, in these diagnoses, what was sort of the metric or the determination of that?
So what we did, and 100% is
right.
Not okay, just because I don't want to say that I said that. A couple things is one, we brought in team members across the United States. So we pulled in experts, stood up a fusion cell that was there at Fort Lewis, not part of Madigan Army Medical Center. So it was an independent review that actually went back and looked at administratively all of the medical records when they saw that there was any diagnoses that may have been changed. So regardless of the intent, okay, that if a diagnosis had a change, they then contacted that service member and offered for that service member to come back to have a reevaluation done. And then if they found that it was confirmed that it was PTSD, then they went through the system. So so probably the best way to say it is that I think every service member had the best opportunity possible to have their record, have a second review, and then be able to go through the disability process if it was found that there was a question.
Okay. So, it's less about the review determining intent of the healthcare provider during it. It's more about
there was investigations which the task force did an oversight in that area. So the part that we did was the administrative kind of clinical review where we wanted to make sure a soldier was not disadvantaged.
And then my other question is just on the numbers of you said, I thought it was interesting that you said that you've overhired in healthcare providers. Well, how many, can you give us perspective of how many you had at the beginning of this process and how you...
I can get those exact numbers for you, but what we've found is that as we've increased the number of our providers, to be honest, the demand's increased. And as you decrease the stigma, the demand's increased, and as you increase access to care. So we have continued to hire, and so what we've done is we don't use the model anymore of what we're authorized. We stopped doing that about 18 months ago. We go with really what's the demand for behavioral health. So that's why I use the word overhire. It's more of what's the demand.
I'm Justin Fish with Fox News. I just want to follow up on Courtney's first question. And someone on the phone might have gotten to this as well. But to the flip side of what she was asking here, was there any evidence that any of these people were seeking benefits as they relate to PTSD in a fraudulent manner? Was that ever a concern? Was there ever any evidence that that was happening pervasive?
That one would not be my answer.
Okay,
so because I didn't look at that. Yeah, I didn't look at that one.
As we look through this, General Bromberg, and Sam, if you have something different or if you have additional information, this is focused on about providing the best possible care to our soldiers and families as they so richly deserve. And there was no evidence, absolutely not, that there was any type of incentives of money going on here or people trying to do fraud to a system at all. Over.
I'm not aware of any evidence either. In addition to the documents you have today, we're finalizing the release of additional documents, including the investigation that reinstated Colonel Hamas, and those should be available next week. But I have not read those investigations, so I cannot comment.
And one of the policies that I put out is that, which not only have we standardized care, but we also accept the VA's compensation and pension exam. And so the reason why that's important, we've given the benefit of the doubt to the soldier and then allow the disability process to make that determination. So we do the medical piece of it, and then the evaluation system, disability, does that piece.
Okay.
So they're very separate.
What's the headline of your report today? What should we be taking from this report?
I think the headline is that no systemic issue of soldiers being disadvantaged in our disability process, and that the Army is committed to taking care of our soldiers that have given so much to our nation over the last 12 years of war.
And I would add that the Army will be better postured the next time there's a deployment. We'll be better postured to provide care and treatment for soldiers and families. And there's also the part about IDES efficiency. We've learned so much in the last several years that IDES now falls under one lead agent, that's General Bromberg, who will orchestrate all the numerous agencies and coordinate with the VA to ensure efficiency. So there's much, much better transparency in the process, but more efficiency.
Let's go out to Fed News Radio, and then we'll follow with NBC.com. Jared, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks. My question is actually on that exact topic. Can you just update us on where you are with total IDES processing times? The last reported number I'm aware of was 395 days in the AC end-to-end as of last summer. Is that number coming down at all? It's General Bromberg. That number is coming down. The last number we have is a little over 400 days, actually. But what I want you to focus on is, as you know, this system, we've taken a legacy system and went back many, many years, and we've combined it into an integrated system with the VA. And what we've learned over the last year, because we've been out looking at this even before the report and during the report, is we've identified some training gaps and products that we went after right away. As I noticed, as I said earlier, we know this can be a frustrating and complicated system for the soldier and their family. So we're focused on not only just training the soldiers or educating the soldiers and their families on how this process works, but also educating the leadership and getting the leadership involved. So the leadership understands the challenges of the system, can help soldiers navigate their way through the system. We've looked at the information technology systems that support IDES. I mean, 18 months ago, we were doing paper, massive Xeroxing in huge boxes. We've gone to electronic systems to help speed the process up. We partner with the VA at every step of the way. We've co-located services with the VA to make things easier for the soldier to navigate his way through. So the numbers are coming down, and last month was our first month that our input into the system actually equaled the output. We've increased capacity at the medical evaluation board point. We've increased capacity at the physical evaluation board point and also at the Veterans Affairs. So I think these numbers are going to come down. The Department of Defense goal is 295 days, and that is a goal, but what we're mainly focused on is care for the soldier. If it takes a few more days right now, that's fine. If we want to make sure the soldier is taken care of all the way through the system, they understand the system, and they're getting the care that they need. And I think with these improvements we've made, and we'll continue to make these improvements, the amount of time in the system will continually come down. So I think we're on the right path, more work to do. And I think the big thing that does get sometimes a little bit overlooked is our goal is to make sure the soldier has benefits upon release from the military within 30 days of the Veterans Affairs versus the legacy way we're doing it, where soldiers would sometimes wait 18 and 24 months after they're out of the military for the benefits to kick in. So that's what we're focused on, quality care, taking care of these young men and women that deserve so much from us, and also making sure those benefits are linked. Over.
And if I could just add to that from the medical evaluation piece, because of the improvements from the time that someone gets put on a profile all the way through the system, we've actually, over the last 6 months, seen a consecutive increase of the number of cases that are moving out of the medical evaluation process, so more moving out than actually going into the process. That's a huge change. We've had a 33-day improvement in the MEB process across all the compos. So it's not just our active component, but it's our reserve and our National Guard. And then we've also seen a 39-day improvement with our narrative summaries. And so that's the document that consolidates all the information then as it goes with the MEB into the PEB, Physical Evaluation Board. And so we're chipping away at the days and trying very, very aggressively to streamline all of our processes.
Jared, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, real quick, there's a recommendation in there to work with G6 to develop a single tracking application. Is that intended to be facing to the soldier so the soldier is able to see where he is in the IDES process?
That is. That is actually a task to ensure that we have visibility over where the soldier is in the process and that commanders and users and practitioners as well as the soldier can go in there and see progress. The Department of Defense has taken this on across all the services and have a task force right now ongoing to look at how we would transfer that data and continue that system over to the VA. And so they're looking at various courses of action right now. But the intent would be an IT system that would integrate with the VA and actually with the other services where data would be standard, where authoritative sources would control the data, and where users and soldiers could access the process to determine where they are in the process. And that was a key recommendation.
All right. Thank you.
Rebecca, we'll come back to you in just a moment. You'll be followed by Jennifer Ladd, and then we'll go to government executive. Rebecca Ruiz, NBC.com. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a clarification and then a question. I think someone just said that a separate report on Madigan will be released next week. Did I hear that correctly?
Right now, as I mentioned, we're finalizing the release of additional documents, and we expect those available next week. Included in that would be the investigation that led to the reinstatement of Colonel Hamas as commander of Madigan Army Medical Center. In the CD that you have other documents, the Army Audit Agency report and the IG report. The IG report focuses on the IDES and some of the gaps that General Bromberg addressed that we jumped on right away for and implemented solutions to. So all that's in your CD. But there will be more documents released next week.
Okay, and then to Lieutenant General Horro or anyone else on that panel, Representative Waltz, you know, introduced legislation to extend the authority and time frame of IDES to include review of those 30,000 service members who are discharged with a personality or anxiety disorder. In your view, would that duplicate the military-wide review that's ongoing?
I don't think it'll duplicate it. We're waiting for that guidance to come down from OSD with the major review that's going to look at those other diagnoses that are non-PTSD related diagnoses. So I think what was in underneath the congressman's intent is actually part of what OSD has already said they're committed to do the review on, if I read that correctly.
Okay, Rebecca, thank you. Jennifer, you have a question?
Yes. Did y'all look at all at, you mentioned people who have deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. Did you look at all at people who, soldiers who maybe have PTSD from something like a sexual assault, even if they haven't deployed, and whether or not those diagnoses were given incorrectly or correctly in certain areas or by certain hospitals? And also, I saw something in here, but I was just wondering also about if you looked at people who had behavioral health issues unrelated to the Army at all, but who had been gotten into the Army without maybe anyone realizing, including themselves, how that's working, because it says something about they wouldn't be going through this system, and I didn't know. That sounds negative to me, but maybe it's a good thing that they wouldn't be going through the system if they are diagnosed with a personality disorder and have not deployed to a combat environment. But it says they are processed unnecessarily through IDES rather than administratively discharged. I'm just trying to wrap my head around this. So I don't. If someone is diagnosed with a personality disorder and they haven't deployed, this report is saying they should just automatically be discharged versus having any kind of review of it. Is that what I'm reading?
This would be non.
Okay.
This is Colonel Stevens. Ma'am, you hit on the two recommendations that the Secretary did not accept.
Okay.
The first one he did not accept it, and he actually modified in his action plan how it's another course of action, and that is to have an Army regulation that governs the administrative separation of soldiers changed such that exactly what you were talking about, those soldiers who may have PTSD from something other than combat or being in a combat zone would still be afforded an appropriate behavioral health evaluation before that administrative separation is finalized to ensure that PTSD or traumatic brain injury or some other behavioral health diagnosis was not a factor that could be contributing to the problems that they're having, so that they would be appropriately taken through the IDES if appropriate instead of administratively separated. The second recommendation that he did not accept and did not come up with an alternative course of action for that one, he just flatly did not accept it, was making a change or seeking a change in statute or in law that would allow a soldier to serve for up to a year and still be able to be administratively separated. That has been considered in the past on numerous times and has been found to be something that we're not interested in pursuing for several reasons. First of all, we feel like that a soldier that's in his or her early training is in a more controlled environment, so they've got much more observation and ability to see what's going on with them, and then lead them down to an administrative separation for something that pre-existed in the military, if appropriate. There would also be a concern that the leaders in those basic training units may not be as willing to make the hard call for those soldiers to administratively separate them and let them go to the operational force where you know, after they finish their training, we're still within that one-year time period. Instead of making the appropriate call and administratively separating them because it would be clear that Army life may not be for them. And then finally, there's one other one.
In the past, there have been many studies and many reviews of this, and it is in statute, so we have 180 days, 6 months to make the call of a pre-existing condition for discharge. That's fair to the soldier, that's fair to the Army. After that period, there are too many issues associated with service aggravation of the condition. You just can't tell.
Right.
Too much time has elapsed, so we stuck with 180 days, and that's in the law. And the VA supports that, and so we didn't want to stretch that out to a year.
Sure. Mr. Redford hit on the other key point, that is that would have implications for VA benefits that are not available to soldiers who are administratively separated that they would be eligible for if they were otherwise separated.
Okay. And was there anything on sexual? Or was that...
That was included in the PTSD.
General Bomber, I just want to jump in here for some clarity because I heard something, ma'am, but the integrated disability system or even the legacy disability system is not, it is for anybody who has a medical condition where they can no longer serve in the military.
Okay.
And it's not just related to deployment. So this disability system is available to all service members, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, and that's the process we use if you get hurt in a training accident or you have some other condition that allows you or prohibits you from continuing service on active duty.
Okay. Thank you, sir. We'll go to Government Executive and then to Army News and AP. Go ahead, Government Executive. Are you there, Government Exec? We'll go to Army News. Gary?
This is Dave from Army News. I didn't have any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Dave. Sorry. We'll go to Sagar Magani of AP. Sagar? We've covered everyone that I know is on the line. I'll just go down the roster. Jim Dow, New York Times. Helen Reinhart. Drew Brooks, Gordon Block, other callers have any questions?
Hi, this is Gene Johnson with the Associated Press out in Seattle.
Hi, Gene.
I just had a quick question. The report did mention that there were these two locations that had higher variance rates than the Army-wide average. I'm assuming one of those was Madigan. What was the other?
Fort Irwin and part of that is a lot of the behavioral health care is in the civilian sector because of the remoteness of where they're at.
Okay.
And so it was a little higher, but it was still within variance tolerance, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Follow up, Gene? Are there other?
Yeah, that was all.
Okay, good. Other distant callers, any final questions?
I just want to follow up on Gene there.
All right, John Ball, who's up?
Go ahead, Al. Okay, I just wonder very briefly, the rating study is shown a lot, as estimated PTSD incident is 15 to 20%, that the VA diagnoses are a much, much higher percentage than 5%. If the 5% figure that you're using on PTSD diagnosis, whether you're concerned that there's been an underdiagnosis, considering that other estimates are so much higher and that these people are being diagnosed with PTSD at considerably higher rates in the VA system. So either you're not catching it or you're not treating it and they're leaving it and developing it. This is a real issue in the sense that we just had a young man from Seattle who 6 years, he's been out 6 years, struggled with PTSD, and was killed attempting to shoot a cop, a policeman, just this week. So we see these things. So I just wonder if someone could comment very briefly on the 5% rate that was cited in the report versus the higher rate that they reported elsewhere?
I'll answer. I'm not tracking a 5%, so, but what I can share with you is that when we looked at the 154,000 records, we had 38% of those had a behavioral health diagnosis. And so that's going back to 9/11 forward. And then of those, 17% of those had a PTSD diagnosis. So 38% had some type of a behavioral health diagnosis, and then 17% of those had a PTSD diagnosis. I don't know if that...
Yeah, that helps. So just to clarify, then the 5% picture referred to the people who didn't get better from that. So there was this 17% was the initial diagnosis, but the 5% figure cited in the report was people.
Take that.
We'll put that under the microscope and get back with you, Hal.
Okay, I apologize.
No, that's okay.
Go ahead, Adam.
Okay, so the two hospitals that are mentioned in the report with the...
And this will be the last question, if I may, because we are about out of time.
Sure, no, that's fine.
Thank you.
I just want to make sure I got this right. The two hospitals with a variance that's out of the norm are Fort Irwin and Madigan. Is that correct?
Yeah, Fort Polk and Fort Irwin were two hospitals that were, when we did a whole systemic one, both Polk and Irwin, rely, you know, they're a small population, and they also rely on the civilian population. So the mixture of the type of providers that were providing that care, both of those were still way under a variance level. And so we looked at all the records, but I didn't go and have a further deep dive in there because I didn't think it was warranted.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, our hour is almost up. I'm going to... offer a moment to Mr. Rutherford, and then I'll give you some final admin notes. Go ahead, sir.
I just want to mention that nobody asked a question about how we're going to implement this. There will be an implementation plan developed, and we'll probably put this under the existing Health Promotion Risk Reduction Council, which has three co-chairs under the Deputy Assistant Secretary to Victor Lamont, who's the Assistant Secretary for Manpower and Reserve Affairs. The Secretary has asked for quarterly updates on progress. We have about a year time frame to get most things in motion. As you know, some of these are very complex. The IT part is complex. The hiring, the embedded behavioral health in the units, it will take longer than that. But there will be a forthcoming plan to monitor and put some rigor in the oversight to make sure everything happens. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Briefly, if you have any follow-on questions, I'll give you an email address and a phone number for Lieutenant Colonel Platt. That's P-L-A-T-T. He's at Stephen with a P-H dot Platt at U.S.Army.mil. Again, Stephen with a P-H dot Platt at U.S.Army.mil. And his direct line is 703-693-5084. I want to thank you all for spending an hour with us. Feel free to contact us at any time about Army matters, and we look forward to working with you again soon. Mr. Rutherford,
thank
Generals,
you.
General Bromberg, thank you all. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Hillary on now.
You would.
Thank you. I think